stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith can get those questions answered right here on this program. Now, today we're not going to be taking any calls or any texts or anything like that. We're strictly going to do emails today. This is a special mailbag edition of our program. We actually get more emails than we can answer during the course of our live show Monday through Friday, because the focus of that is normally phone calls and texts and things of that sort. So the emails, as they are accumulating in our little mailbag here, we'll set those aside. When we have enough to make a show, we'll make a show. And that's what we're doing today. Me, Tom Price, and you, Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How about you, my friend?
I am hanging in there. Thank you.
Glad to hear that. We're going to lead off today with an email from Christine. Christine says, my husband questions the existence of God in that he does not see the evidence for his existence. He says he is looking for concrete and tangible proof. He says he needs to be, quote, hit over the head with something in order to believe. Any thoughts? Thanks,
yeah,
Christine.
Absolutely. Thank you, Christine, very much. I really appreciate it. So there was a famous Russian cosmonaut who got in a spaceship and flew into outer space and then radioed back, laughing and sneeringly joked that he didn't see God in outer space. And all the Catholics in the audience were not surprised that he failed to see God, and the really scary thing would have been if he had claimed to see him,
yeah,
right? Because we think there's incredibly strong evidence for the existence of God, really demonstrative evidence for the existence of God, but it's for the existence of the kind of God that you would never expect to see in a microscope or at the end of a telescope or, you know, from a vantage point in outer space. And the reason why is that the Catholic Church does not believe that God is an object in the physical universe existing alongside other objects. In fact, even if you imagine something bigger than the physical universe, if you imagine like the set of all existing objects or possible existing objects that you might conceive of in any possible universe, in any construal you can imagine of any kind of relations, God would not be a member of that set, all right? And this is explicit Catholic teaching, right? A better analogy would be if you can let's go back to that set theory analogy again.
Okay.
Imagine the set of all two-dimensional objects that you could fit in a geometric plane. Or if you've taken geometry, you know what a plane is.
Two-dimensional
extension, or I guess three-dimensional extent. Well, two dimensions extending, you know, infinitely in every direction. All right. And you imagine the set of all possible objects that you could put in that plane. Well, God would not be analogous to any object, no matter how you drew it, and whatever its relation would be to any other object in that geometric plane. He's the plane. He's the plane. All right. You know, there was a science fiction writer and lay theologian whose name escapes me at the moment, but wrote a famous novel called Flatland that actually plays with this analogy a little bit. Flatland is about a world of two-dimensional creatures. They live in a world of two dimensions. And someone comes and says to them, well, you know, there's this thing called a sphere. And they go, what is that? Well, try describing a sphere to something that lives in two dimensions.
Yeah.
Well, it becomes impossible. You go, well, it's a little bit like a point. It's a little bit like a circle. It's a little bit like a bigger circle, and then a smaller circle, and a smaller circle. Because the only way a two-dimensional creature could experience a sphere would be you pass it through the plane. And what would they see? First a dot, and then a circle growing larger, and then a circle growing smaller, and the end of the dot. And they go, okay, I know what a sphere is. It's a bunch of dots and circles. No, it isn't. You're not getting it. All right, you're not getting it. St. Paul says in Acts chapter 17 that it is God in whom we live and move and have our being. in whom we live and move and have our being. Even you, when you consider the Christian doctrine of creation, the Catholic doctrine of creation, there are some who misconstrue the Catholic doctrine of creation, imagining that creation means that God intervened at a point in time to set up the world and then stepped back and let it go, as if, you know, God was an object who you know, set the ball rolling, and then there goes the ball rolling. Right? No, creation, the Christian doctrine of creation, establishes not a moment in time, all right, but an eternal relation of God to the created order.
Okay.
This is abstract language that I'm using, and I'm doing so for a reason, because the church is very specific in what it means when it talks about God. Okay. Now, what would be the evidence for the existence of the plane in the flatland analogy? What would be the evidence for the existence of a relation of creator to creature? All right. The Fourth Lateran Council defines God as the first principle, primo principio. A principle is that from which things proceed. Right?
Okay.
Is there evidence that reality as such proceeds as an effect from a cause? Is there evidence that reality proceeds as an effect from a cause? Well, the evidence is so massive and ubiquitous that it undergirds every act of reasoning we are engaged in. All right. Any attempt that I bring to understand any object of my experience presupposes the notion of cause and effect.
Okay.
Well, what is this coffee cup on my desk right here? Well, any adequate account I can give of that coffee cup is going to conceive of its molecular structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's the purpose that it serves, namely to hold my coffee or my tea, its origin in time, its manufacturing. You know, there are a number of ways of analyzing the coffee cup that pertain to the reason for its being. I mean, why is it here? What does it do? How is it constructed? What sense can I make rationally of the coffee cup? All right. All of those proceed from some notion of intelligibility, of some reason for its being.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And everything in my experience is like this, in that every object in the material world I can point to and raise that set of questions about, that means that they're contingent. They stand in need of explanation. Right.
Okay.
The philosopher William Lane Craig uses this analogy. He says, if I were walking through the woods and I found a giant glowing blue sphere, all right, what would I think? What would be the first thing that I would think? What is it and why is it here?
Yeah.
All right. That's what reason does. That's a rational response to the glowing blue sphere. Now, keep blowing that blue sphere up in your imagination so that it's the size of a house, and now it's the size of Mount Everest, and now it's the size of the Earth, and now it's the size of the solar system, and now that blue sphere is the size of whatever is the finite size of the physical universe. Does the problem go away as the sphere gets larger, or does the problem become bigger? It becomes bigger.
Sure.
It doesn't go away. As long as you're dealing with contingent reality, dependent reality, it stands in need of explanation. All right?
Okay.
If you think there is an explanation for reality, that whatever that is, that's simply what the Catholic tradition means by the word God. God is the source of the intelligibility of the universe, the ground or first principle of created reality. Beyond that, reason cannot go. So when you ask, what is God, God himself, what is God's intrinsic nature or essence? We have no idea, nor do we need to have any idea. We have evidence of his effects, not of his essence. Now, if those distinctions make sense to you, that is a layman's short case philosophically for the existence of the God in whom Catholics believe. Now, I'd like to give you some further resources to explore these ideas in greater depth for your husband. Okay, one of them would be Edward Faser's new book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God, Edward Faser, F-E-S-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Another one would be David Bentley Hart, his book, The Experience of God. Both of those are going to take a deep philosophical look at some of these ideas I've raised, but with much more depth, much more analytical sophistication, book-length treatments that I think if your husband reads, he will not walk away from that experience if he gives it an honest look and say there's no evidence for the existence of God.
Okay, very good. Christine, thank you so much for your email. We're going to come back in just a moment here. Lots more great emails on this mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Catherine Hadro.
Every week, I get together with a team of pro-life experts to shine the light of truth on abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and the culture of death. We'll help to inform you so you can become engaged in the pro-life movement. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, more than a show, a call to action.
EWTN Pro-Life Weekly with Catherine Hadro, Sunday morning at 10:30 on EWTN Radio.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John 6, verses 48 to 58. Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread," meaning me. "This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and never die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh." At which the Jews disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" They're scandalized by this. How is it that we're not? How is it that we just hear this and go, "Oh yeah, I know that passage"? They're just outraged and at least perplexed. Sane people, inspired teachers, wise men, prophets don't say things like this.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders.
And we're not taking phone calls today or texts or anything like that. We are taking care of some emails on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. And if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here is the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Here's one now, David, from Brian, who says, "Can you please explain to me why the Catholic Church does not acknowledge sin which takes place inside the church? Does the role of Catholic social justice in the church provide a solution in part to the injustices that may arise with some members of the church? Thanks, Brian."
Okay, so I think I know what you're asking. I think you're asking, why doesn't the church point out or call to account every specific instance of personal sin among her members and especially her clergy? That is absolutely impossible to do.
Yeah.
All right. Sin is very often a secret affair. I mean, Tom, you wouldn't know if I had sinned this morning on my way into work. You wouldn't know if I had lusted or been angry or impatient or impure of heart or greedy or avaricious. You wouldn't know that, you know. And in fact, you know, maybe I'm really good at putting on a front. I think I am pretty good at putting on a front, by the way, you know, which is why I tell people they have nice things to say. And I'm like, "Look, you only know what fits through this microphone. You don't know my real life. You know, I'm a pretty bad guy, honestly."
No,
you know,
I don't think so.
Well, my confessor might say otherwise, okay. You know, but you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. So, I mean, I don't know how you would expect that the church could possibly know the private sins of her members. And when she does learn of the private sins of her members, that would only be in the context of the confessional, when it's just between the penitent and the priest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, when it comes to public injustices in the church actually has the most ancient and sophisticated legal system in the entire world. It's called the Code of Canon Law. In fact, the whole Western legal system is grounded to a certain extent, on the Code of Canon Law. In fact, mm-hmm. I read an article by a Harvard law professor not too long ago, who was examining the origins of the principle of reasonable doubt, you know, that namely that a jury can convict a candidate. I mean, not a candidate. I was just reading election coverage. It'd be nice to convict some candidates. Can convict an alleged perpetrator of a crime if they're certain beyond a reasonable doubt. All right. Well, where did that idea come from? Well, it actually comes is embedded in Catholic moral theology, and the idea was, if you have a capital case, so somebody's life is potentially on the line. If they're convicted, they could be executed. Can a juror, in good conscience, you know, cast a vote for conviction? If they don't have absolute rock solid certainty and like they witnessed the crime, you know, can they have that person's blood on their hands potentially if they vote for conviction? Mm-hmm. All right, and so the Catholic thinkers, theologians, and legal jurists had to come up with a way to say, well, how could we rationally justify? How could we rationally warrant the moral responsibility of jurors to take a position in what might be a capital case? And they reasoned from principles of Catholic moral theology that if the jury could be certain beyond a reasonable doubt in guilt, then they were morally warranted in voting for a conviction. Well, the whole structure of the argument and the thinking and the moral reasoning is born out of Catholic legal theory, grounded in Catholic moral theology, right? So that was a little aside. But namely, the point was that there is a highly sophisticated system of administering justice within the Church's code of canon law. And it's been a model for the Western legal system and therefore indirectly for legal systems throughout the world. Having a just law or having a just legal system is different from enforcing it. All right. Mm. And the enforcement mechanisms of any legal system are going to be limited. You know, I mean, even in civil law or criminal law, we probably actually convict. I don't know what the percentages are, but my guess is it would be a fraction of the percent of actual crimes committed are ever brought to trial and result in convictions. And that's just the nature of the beast, right? Because most crimes are going to be committed in secret and people are going to try to evade capture and so forth, and the same thing's true within the Church. But there are plenty of convictions. I mean, there are people sitting right now, even in the Vatican's jail, people who've committed civil crimes in the Vatican City State and have gone to jail. All right, there are others who are subject to canonical penalties, and you know, have their faculties removed, for instance, to celebrate Mass. Sometimes they're handed over to the public arm of law if they've committed a criminal charge and so forth. And, you know, here at EWTN, we have one of the friars, Father John Paul, has been commissioned by the Pope as a missionary of mercy. Well, that sounds real quaint and sentimental, all right? But actually, one of the jobs of the missionaries of mercy is to kind of get down and dirty, if you will, into the thick of dealing in canonical penalties, most of which have been levied against priests because they've committed some crime, all right? And there's a pretty sophisticated system within the Church for how do you handle priests that have done wrong. And why does this not come to your attention? Well, you don't need to know.
That's exactly right.
You don't need to know. You know, I was talking to a canonist, a friend of mine, a very good canonist, highly regarded canonist, and she said to me, you know, you have to have a certain kind of temperament to be a canon lawyer. I was thinking, I thought she was going to say, well, you know, you have to be analytical and detail-oriented. That's not what she meant. What she said to me was, no, that's not what I mean. What I mean is, you can't be the sort of person whose faith would be shaken when you learn about deep, dark, and dirty things that have taken place in the Church. All right, you have to have a pretty realistic view of the human person and the way grace operates and the nature of sin. Because if something makes it to my desk, usually it's a big problem.
Yeah.
It's a big problem. And which means, I mean, the canonists, the you know, Church and civil attorneys are sitting there slugging through stuff like this all day long. But you're not going to hear about it. And you shouldn't.
Right. Yeah. That's it.
So I guess I don't agree with the premise of the question.
Okay.
Very good. Brian, thank you so much for it. This is a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Dave, checking us out on YouTube, wants to know, why does the King James Version of the Bible include, "For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory," etc., while Catholic Bibles do not? I'm talking here about Matthew 6:9. I was told that Jesus simply didn't say it.
Oh, well, no. I mean, there are different renditions of the Lord's Prayer in different Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a longer ending and there's a shorter ending. You can speculate about which is more probable, all right, to have been uttered by the historic words of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
There's a principal and textual criticism, which is I'm trying to remember what the principle is. I don't want to misspeak. Textual critics deal with this kind of stuff. They try, if there's two different versions of something in the Gospels, mm-hmm. they try to ascertain, well, which one is more likely to have been said by the historical Christ. But it's irrelevant in terms of the theological content because let's say, first of all, there's a couple possibilities for harmonization. One is, let's say Jesus gave out the Lord's Prayer on two different occasions. He could have given us two different versions to two different audiences. That's a plausible explanation.
Sure.
All right. Another one is, let's say Jesus enunciated the shorter version, and the apostles got in the habit of praying it. All right. And then someplace along the while, before the actual historical Gospel of Matthew got written, they for whatever reason, the liturgy develops,
mm-hmm.
and they tack on the longer ending with mm-hmm. the Lord's approval. That's another plausible interpretation.
Yeah.
Another would be simply that obviously, at the time of the writing of the Gospel of Matthew, the longer ending had become standard form in at least one liturgical community. The historical origins of that aren't necessarily important for us to know. What is important for us to know is that the Gospel of Matthew is inspired Scripture, right? And so the authority inheres not in what historical imagination can dredge up from the inaccessible past, but the authority inheres in the text as it stands. So anytime somebody wants to raise a question about, well, whether historical Jesus said this or that, I mean, that's very interesting, and we can speculate.
Yeah.
But nothing hangs on that question theologically, all right? Because as Catholics, we think that the ink on the page was superintended by the Holy Spirit. So whatever process of transmission went into the ink on the page,
uh-huh.
right, at the moment that the page got inked, the Holy Spirit was concurrent in that activity, and so it becomes for us theologically authoritative. So even if, the Spirit of Christ inspires the writer of the Gospel in a way that subtly differs from what may have happened in 30 AD,
mm-hmm.
that's of no consequence in terms of our actual prayer life, because we follow the sacred scriptures as God's inspired word and sacred tradition. And these questions are of historical interest, but they're not of either liturgical or theological significance.
Dave, thank you for your question. Glad you're checking us out on YouTube. This is a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Matt wants to know, could you please speak a little about Pope Francis's epistle on Gnosticism?
Yeah. Okay, so Francis didn't write an epistle on Gnosticism. Francis recently wrote an apostolic exhortation on Christian holiness, in which he talked about Neo-Pelagianism and Neo-Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the office in the Vatican that deals with questions of Catholic doctrine,
mm-hmm.
Issued a statement a month or two ago clarifying the Pope's meaning which he often does, refers to the heresies of Neo-Gnosticism and Neo-Pelagianism. All right, and he's referred to these ideas frequently, all right, not just in his apostolic exhortation, but in many public addresses and documents. So let's go back and look a little bit at what Gnosticism and Pelagianism were, all right, and then try to bring that up to date in terms of the Pope's usage.
Okay.
All right, so Gnosticism was a second-century heresy, and it was really born out of Greek philosophy and the mystery religions of Rome and Greece, and it incorporated some Christian ideas, imagery, and language, but the real spirit of the thing was not Christian. It was you know, Greek philosophical speculation and mystery religions. And the idea behind Gnosticism was that the material world is evil. Material world is evil, and it is only the realm of the immaterial or the spiritual that that matters. And some of the Gnostics went so far as to imagine that the Old and New Testament represented the evil and good principles, respectively, and even imagined that there were two gods, a god of the Old Testament and a god of the New.
Wow.
And since the spiritual realm is the realm of knowledge, right, knowledge in the intellect, that it is knowledge, essentially, that saves us, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are initiated into secret wisdom, then you can be sucked out of this changing world of matter, all right? Let's come back to this idea after the break.
Sounds good. We'll continue that thought. We're also going to get to quite a few more emails here on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Don't go away. Lots more straight ahead here on Call to Communion. The EWTN home video highlight for June is Total Consecration to Jesus Through Mary. Shot on location at Our Lady of Peace Shrine in Santa Clara, California, this EWTN original series shows you how total consecration to Jesus through Mary can overcome evil and bring peace. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi, I'm Doug Keck, and this is an EWTN Bookmark Brief. I just finished talking with Father Joseph Roche, a friend of ours from the Marians of the Immaculate Conception. And the book is Fatima, A Pilgrimage with Mary, published by our friends at Marian Press. Tell us, Father Joe, give us an overview of what this book's about.
Well, it's a beautiful picture book, what we call a coffee table book, with some beautiful pictures of the shrine of Our Lady of Fatima. And it tells the story of the apparitions of Our Lady that took place 100 years ago. It tells us about the situation in the world today. And Our Lady is really, in this book, taking us on a pilgrimage, helping us to meet her son Jesus, helping us to recognize that the heart of the world is Jesus and the Eucharist, and that if we open our hearts to him, we can do our part to change the world.
The book is Fatima, A Pilgrimage with Mary by the Marian Press, available through the EWTN Religious Catalog. EWTNRC.com is the place you can find it. This has been a Bookmark Brief. Thanks for stopping by.
Catholic Radio gives us an opportunity to become part of a larger family. It can be so lonely when we are struggling in our faith or just try to live our faith on our own. But Catholic Radio connects us to that larger community of faith where we're able to get the support, the encouragement, and the grace that we need to not just struggle on, but to really celebrate all the blessings that God brings into our life through our Catholic faith.
Dr. Greg Popcheck thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Hi, this is Cy Kellett. Later today on Catholic Answers Live, join us as we roll out our brand new Friday game show, Catholic Answers Live, 6 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders.
Glad you could join us for this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. So before the break, David and I were talking about Gnosticism.
Sure. So we had an email that wanted to understand the Pope's references to neo-Gnosticism,
right,
neo-Pelagianism,
mm-hmm,
and the letter from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which was titled Placuit Deo, that's the name of the document, on the Pope's use of these terms. So the ancient heresy of Gnosticism believed that salvation came through knowledge, not through anything involving the body or the flesh, because the Gnostics regarded the material world as evil, and that by initiation into spiritual mysteries, one could be kind of, you know, sucked out of this evil material world and saved. All right. Pelagianism was an ancient heresy associated with a British monk, lay monk, whose name was Pelagius. And Pelagius got real bent out of shape when he encountered St. Augustine's prayer, Lord, command what you will and grant what you command.
Mm.
And Augustine had appealed to God for the strength to keep the divine command. And, of course, relying on God's grace. And Pelagius got irritated at that because he thought, well, doesn't that suggest that we don't have the ability to keep God's commands? And Pelagius's intuition was correct. That's exactly what it implied. St. Augustine intended to communicate that without the grace of God, his commands are impossible. With the grace of God, they are not impossible. All right? But Pelagius thought that that would actually weaken the human resolve to do good. And in his theology, grace was something that was external to the human soul. It was, came to us through the example of Jesus, his moral teaching, the laws of sacred scripture, the admonitions of the Bible, you know, the promise of the reward of eternal life. But all these things could work upon us only psychologically to motivate us to activate what was already within our free will to do. And then, you know, by doing whatever we could, or doing the best we could, which was sufficient, and he thought we could do quite a lot, man could merit salvation without the help of an interior principle actually changing his heart and making him and cooperating with him in the good that he does. So Pelagianism was a form of naturalism, the idea that man in his natural condition already had within him what was necessary for living a holy life. All he had to do was be properly motivated.
Mm-hmm.
The church condemned both Gnosticism and Pelagianism. No, salvation is not merely about acquiring a certain mental attitude or a certain disposition. It does involve one's bodily life. And no, man does not have within his own natural powers all that is necessary for his salvation. He does need grace as an interior principle communicated to him by the Holy Spirit and through the sacraments. Now, Pope Francis is fond of referring to these heresies, and he thinks that he sees them in some manifestations of modern life. And I certainly think I do, too, quite often.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that the Pope mentions this one directly, but I find in the current fascination with transgenderism a reemergence of the ancient Gnostic idea, all right, that it doesn't matter what nature or the body or physical reality or your DNA or your genetics, or none of those things matter in terms of the essential you. The
uh-huh.
essential you is, in the ideology, is just how you feel or think about yourself. Whatever you identify as, that's what you are. And that if there's a conflict between your inner spiritual sense of yourself and physical reality, so much the worse for physical reality, and you should hack, slash, cut, and burn, you know, inject or whatever, in order to bring physical reality in line with this utterly pure conception you have of yourself.
Wow.
And seems to me like a kind of a Gnosticism 2.0,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of other manifestations of Gnosticism, I think, in the modern world. There are elements of Gnostic thinking in Luther's theology, in certain fundamentalist sects, and the evangelicalism that I grew up in which I was taught before I was Catholic that if I believed certain information about God, okay, namely that Christ had died for my sins and that all I had to do was say I was sorry and believe in him, that if I believed certain information about God, that my salvation would be guaranteed, right? Salvation by faith alone through a personal invitation to receive Christ into my life. So through some esoteric religious experience and intellectual assent to a body of esoteric doctrine, that I would thereby attain salvation. Well, it sounds like Gnosticism to me, right? At least that's how I was raised. And
yeah.
One of the reasons I left that tradition is I came to realize how vehemently ancient Christianity had rejected Gnosticism.
Mm-hmm.
And we could look at other instances. You know, when it comes to Pelagianism, oh, boy, Pelagianism is everywhere. It's all over the place, all right? I mean, I within and outside the church. And I talk to people all the time, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, who seem to believe that the goal of life or the motive of life is it can be reduced simply to either social action or the imposition of a political program or an ideological program. And I don't think that notion is limited to the right or the left of the political spectrum within or without of the church.
Really?
And sure. So anytime you see someone, this is my judgment. All right.
Sure,
I think,
sure.
And I think here's where this is where Pope Francis sees also.
Mm-hmm.
When you encounter, let's say within the Catholic Church, you encounter a Catholic that says, you know, here is my pet theological project.
Mm-hmm.
Now your pet theological project might be adherence to this or that form of the liturgy, to this or that devotional practice, to this or that social program, to this or that construal of political life, whatever mm-hmm. it might be. I have got my project, and I know that that's the pure good stuff, right? And if only we could impose my pet project on the structure of either the church or civil society, then salvation would result. Mm. All right, and I encounter that all the time.
Oh yeah.
All right, and look, I think we're all given to this, and I'm given to ideological thinking myself, and I think we all are. Like we have a tendency to want to simplify reality down into a formula,
mm-hmm.
and then when we arrive at a formula that seems to make sense of reality to us, then we look around and notice how stupid everybody else is that they don't see what we see. You know, this is a natural human tendency,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then we think if everybody would just listen to me for 5 minutes, we could sort out all the world's problems, you know?
Sure.
And so, you know, Pope Francis called out in Evangelii Gaudium one particular manifestation of this. And it was, you know, those that have a kind of, you know, pedantic, punctilious concern for the niceties of liturgy. A friend of ours at EWTN once talked to me about what he called the heresy of sola liturgica. you know, if only we get the every fine jot and tittle right, then voila, you know, transformation will occur and the human life will be glorious. And that's naive, of course.
Of course.
That's naive. You know, St. Francis de Sales talked about that a long time ago in his Introduction to the Devout Life. He says, look, true devotion is not praying the rosary. It's not even giving alms. It's not doing fasts, you know, all those things are good. But true devotion is nothing other than the love of God and neighbor. And just this morning, I was reading St. John Cassian's Institutes. John Cassian, of course, was a 5th century monk who went and interviewed a lot of the Egyptian hermits from the deserts of Syria and Egypt, the famous monastic spiritual athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And in his interview with Abbot Moses, a famous monk, you know, what is the spiritual life all about? And Abbot Moses said, it's not about fasts or vigils or prayers or almsgiving or any of that stuff. He says, all that's good. But it's just a means to an end. And the end is to obtain purity of heart and the vision of God. All right. And I was reading someone from a completely different tradition, St. Seraphim of Sarov, a Russian Orthodox monk and mystic who's highly regarded even by the popes, who said same thing, exact same language.
Really?
It's not about this, that, or the other good work. All those things can be useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's about coming into relationship with the Holy Spirit.
It's pretty solid.
Yeah. And so we're all given to these superstitions and these temptations. So let us guard against them. And, you know, read Placuit Dei, read the CDF's letter on Neo-Pelagianism and Neo-Gnosticism. It's a good document.
Matt, thank you so much for your question. This is a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Interesting question here from John, checking us out on YouTube. Why do you think Islam is increasing in growth?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, I'm not an expert in this topic.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, I mean, anytime I make an empirical claim about which I'm inexpert, I am absolutely open to correction.
Okay, so billboarding that up front.
If you're a demographer and you know more about this than I do, then by all means let me know. But what my layman's knowledge on this says that it's mostly through demographics. It's mostly through childbirth.
Uh-huh.
That if you look at the rates of childbirth in Muslim and non-Muslim, especially modern Western civilization,
mm-hmm.
The Muslim families just way out reproduce. They just way out reproduce. I mean, I think I understand that in London, I think the most common infant baby boy's name right now is Muhammad.
Really?
Now, Muslims are a minority of the British population. I mean, they're a significant minority, but they're a minority of the population. But if the most common name in the city is Muhammad, you know that they're like, and when it comes to the population under two,
uh-huh.
you know, they're catching up fast.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that's most of it. I think mostly it's due to demography.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that, John. Thanks also for checking us out on YouTube. Here's an interesting one from Gold Nelly. This is a text that came in. When or why did priests begin wearing the Roman collar? You know anything about that?
No.
Really?
No. I mean, yeah, I know some stuff anecdotally, but if I say anything, I'll get my head handed to me, or have my collar ripped off.
Well, then we'll just move right
along.
Move
right along.
Sure. Here's one now from Ezra, texted us. Why and when did God create the angels? Specifically, why did God create Lucifer, knowing full well that his actions would help bring about the reality of sin?
Yeah, God created the material and spiritual worlds simultaneously. All right, and in that first moment of creation, the angels were created in grace, meaning that they had that capacity for intimate relationship with God, raised to a supernatural level. And he also gave them the ability to choose. He gave them free will, and he did not admit them to the beatific vision. All right, so they were created in grace, like Adam and Eve were, but in an opportunity where they could choose for or against God. And most chose for him. Some, faced with the temptation to pride, chose against him. And in that moment, the angels that were obedient to the divine command to love God above all things were confirmed in sanctifying grace and admitted immediately to the beatific vision. And then it became impossible for them to ever sin, because once you've been admitted to the beatific vision, you're not going to want anything else.
Right.
It's not like, hey, what's better than the beatific vision? I mean, it's the fulfillment of all desire.
Sure.
So it becomes literally like a psychological and metaphysical impossibility to ever will anything contrary to the will of God when you see the essence of God. And the evil angels, likewise, were confirmed permanently in their rejection of God and eternally rejected from the divine presence. Why did God allow that? Well, because he intended to bring out of it a greater good. And there was speculation in scholastic theology. It's just speculation. We don't really know about whether or not Christ would have become incarnate had Adam not sinned. And there was one theologian, you know who it was, Tom, who took the position that the good of the incarnation was such a great good that even if Adam had not sinned, Christ would still have become incarnate. You know who said that?
Who said that?
That was John Duns Scotus.
Uh-huh.
Okay, he took that position.
Okay.
St. Thomas took another position. St. Thomas said, look, the only reason that Revelation gives us for the incarnation is to atone for sin and to bring salvation. So I'm sticking with the limits of Revelation. You know, Christ became incarnate, planned to become incarnate, was predestined to become incarnate in view of the reality of human sin. All right? And so the fall of Lucifer and the fall of Adam were necessary, with necessary here being in quotes, necessary preconditions for the incarnation of the Son of God. Okay?
Okay.
And that's a pretty great good, the incarnation of the Son of God. So obviously, God intended to allow the possibility of sin, all right, in view of the greater good of the possibility of redemption.
Okay.
Well, not the possibility, but the actuality of redemption.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There we go. Ezra, thank you so much for your text. This is a special mailbag edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. We'll get to a few more of those great questions in just a couple of seconds here. I want to tell you about Catholic News Agency. If you're not familiar with it, you're looking for a trusted source for your news, we got a great one for you. Catholic News Agency is the only fast, reliable, and free Catholic news source that puts blogs, stories, opinions, and lots more right there to your fingertips. So for the latest Catholic news, visit CatholicNewsAgency.com. CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's a free online service from all of us at EWTN. Let's go now to a question from Chris in Denver, checking us out on YouTube. Chris wants to know, what are the differences between the two judgments?
Thank you. So the particular judgment at the moment of your death will admit you immediately to the beatific vision, purgatory, or hell. Okay?
Yep.
The general judgment at the end of time will be accompanied by the resurrection of your physical body. All right? And it will be a public vindication of God in the sight of every man, woman, and child, every rational agent.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be a vindication of you, right? So the final judgment, if you're one of the ones that is blessed enough to go immediately to the beatific vision upon death, the final judgment will be a victory lap, carrying the flag.
It's a good way of looking at it.
Exactly, you know. When God says before all of creation, well done, good and faithful servant, And, you know, look, we all want to have an intimate relationship with God.
Yes.
But let's be honest, we like it when we are praised in front of our peers, too.
Yeah.
And that's not entirely bad, right? I mean, it can be taken in a bad way.
Sure.
Right? But for God to accept and glorify us, and that's what the Scripture says, that if we die in God's grace, ultimately we'll be glorified, right? That is a share in His goodness. Okay. So that's an objectively good thing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris, in Denver, for checking us out on YouTube. Here's a text now from Jacob who says, official Catholic interpretation of Genesis 1 through 3 is that all of humankind is descended from two first parents. This means that in the beginning, humankind would have had to mate with family in order to populate the earth. There was no one other than your sister or your mother to procreate with. So if such inbreeding is a clear problem, not only morally, but also genetically and biologically today, why wasn't it so then? Again, that's from Jacob.
Okay, yeah, thanks. This is, hang on, I'm looking up an article that I want to reference. Oh, there's the article. I got it. Okay,
good.
Thanks. So there are a lot of opinions, different opinions, allowable opinions on the way to answer this question.
Mm-hmm.
The presumption in reading church documents on this issue is for monogenesis, right? The doctrine that we are biologically descended from a first man and a first woman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Beyond that, there's a lot of leeway in Catholic theology and scientific speculation that's allowable on the nature of human origins, all right? And Pope Pius XII wrote a document called Humani Generis, all right, on the origin of the human person, where he laid down the parameters for what should govern Catholic interpretation of the Genesis narrative,
mm-hmm.
as well as interpretation of the anthropological, archaeological, and genetic evidence, all right? And the controlling idea in that document is that the doctrine of original sin, not the Genesis text itself, but the doctrine of original sin seems to require the doctrine of monogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
All right. However, the Pope allows theological and scientific speculation on the possibility of pre-Adamite biological material from which the first human persons may have evolved. All right?
Okay.
Now, if you read the document, you know, prima facie, it comes off pretty strong in favor of monogenesis. There are Catholic theologians who have no intention of dissenting from the Church's teaching. I mean, they're not trying to play fast and loose, all right? Who have given a more, I don't want to use the word liberal in an ideological sense, but like, let's say, broad-minded, creative, wide, expansive interpretation to Humani Generis that says that monogenesis is presumed as the only way to reconcile the biological data with what we know from with what we know about the doctrine of original sin. But, and here's where the speculation enters in, if there were a way to read the biological data,
mm-hmm.
in a way that preserved the doctrine of original sin, while toying around a little bit with the idea of polygenesis, that we could go there in terms of theological speculation, not in terms of Catholic doctrine. Polygenesis, of course, would be the idea of multiple ancestry, not just, you know, two parents.
Right.
And so if you go to the website ThomisticEvolution.com,
mm-hmm.
for instance, you'll find some pretty sophisticated analysis on this issue that at a very high level, that's looking at the biology and the chemistry and the genetics of the thing, along with the relevant theological documents. All right. There's another take that I think is stronger on monogenesis, but also really, really sensitive to the scientific data, and that's the article I was looking up. It's by Kenneth Kemp, and the title of the article is Science, Theology, and Monogenesis. And it's looking at all the ways in which we could reconcile the scientific data with the doctrine of monogenesis. All right, and in terms of the moral question that you raised, I mean, Kemp's going to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether or not we're looking at whether or not we're looking at incest, whether or not we're looking at if there's a larger biological group from which the first human family was created and the possibility of inbreeding there. I mean, there are all kinds of ways of handling that problem. We don't have to dogmatically come down on one or the other, is what I'm saying. But I've given you some data, two sources. Yeah. I want you to take a look at Kenneth Kemp's article in the website, domesticevolution.com.
There you go, Jacob. Thank you for your question. Here's one now from John, who says, Dr. Andrews, if God, in order to be just, must punish sin, and if the crucifixion was not a penal substitution, who bears the punishment for the sins of those who are saved? Did you get that?
Okay, so if God has to punish sin in order to be just,
mm-hmm.
That's the question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question, isn't it? Do we have to construe punishment that way? Okay. So the Catholic view is that Christ atones for sin and makes satisfaction.
Mm.
All right. This is the whole idea of behind an indulgence, right? The idea of an indulgence is that there's something that I can do that can actually remove the penalty of punishment. Right?
Yeah.
If I make some act of reparation, then I may actually have removed the penalty of punishment. Particularly if the penalty of punishment is in the divine realm is alienation from God. I mean, in a sense, like the punishment, sin is its own punishment, right? Within the Catholic tradition. I mean, if I turn my back on God, it's just like, you know, if I quit eating food or quit taking my vitamins because I'm being obstinate.
Uh-huh.
Well, who's going to suffer for that? I am.
Yeah.
You know, and reconciling to the source of my life is simultaneously going to bring health and well-being. Okay. If I turn away from God, I'm punished instantly in the act itself. Sin is its own punishment, right? If I'm reconciled to God, the punishment ceases because I'm not alienated from God anymore.
Right.
Right. I still owe God in justice a debt of reparation, some act of satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that satisfaction can be paid vicariously by Jesus. All right. The idea that, like take my son, for instance. If my son disobeys me and, you know, breaks the window in the kitchen and then apologizes and then says, I'll make it up to you. I don't think that justice requires that I turn around and start beating the dog.
No.
You know, or beating the older brother.
Yeah.
And that somehow or another, you know, he's broken the window. Somebody has to suffer for this. And maybe I'll take it out on the older brother. That doesn't look like justice to me.
No, not at all. Very good. And that's going to do it. Man, a fast-moving hour there. Dr. David Andrews, thank you, my friend.
Thanks, Tom.
Guess what? We do the program each and every Monday through Friday live at 2 p.m. Eastern Time with an encore at 11 p.m. Eastern Time. We also snag the best show of the week in our producer, in his opinion, that is, Michael Birchfield. And we'll air that for you on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. So on behalf of our entire staff here, this is Tom Price wishing you a wonderful day. And be sure to join us for our next live broadcast of Call to Communion here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Have a great day and God bless.